9/11, SARS, and other such crisis situations, more and more professionals are now involved with emergency response planning. An often overlooked but critical aspect of emergency response is crisis communication. What should you say to a public that is frightened, in denial, or even panicky? Peter Sandman, one of the world's preeminent risk communication experts, will offer his advice on crisis communication, guidelines for action, planning what to say when terrorists, epidemics, or other emergencies strike. Dr. Sandman has been working on crisis communication issues since the Three Mile Island accident in 1979. His crisis-related work includes consulting for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and for the World Health Organization. His wife and colleague, Dr. Jody Lenard, advised the World Health Organization on communication about SARS and will also participate in the program.
Hello. We're going to be talking today about crisis communication. Communication during a terrorist attack, communication during a bioterrorist crisis, communication in a major industrial emergency, communication during an epidemic. I used to make a huge distinction. Some of you know I'm sort of known as an expert in risk communication. And I used to make a huge distinction between risk communication and crisis communication. Crisis communication, I would say, is what you do when something awful has happened. And risk communication is what you do when you're talking about whether something awful might happen. That never made a whole lot of sense as a distinction. It's certainly true that in a crisis something awful has happened. But it's also true that in a crisis people are very interested in what awful might additionally happen. So if you look, for example, at Three Mile Island in 1979, one of the first crises I ever worked on, something very bad happened. But those of you who were around during Three Mile Island, the focus was really on what else might go wrong. Might the plant explode? Might there be a meltdown? Similarly with SARS, much more recently, something bad happened. SARS was a crisis. Certainly it was a crisis in Singapore and Toronto and places where there was significant illness. But the real focus with SARS was, could this become a pandemic? Could something awful happen? And of course, the most vivid example of the distinction between risk communication and crisis communication falling apart is terrorism. On 9/11, something horrible happened. But we have arguably been in a terrorism crisis ever since. Some of you know when I talk about risk communication, I tend to talk about the concepts of hazard and outrage, and the distinction between hazard and outrage. For the last 20 years or so, since I invented those concepts, or at least invented the words for those concepts, I have argued essentially that risk is equal to hazard plus outrage, pointing to two very different kinds of risk, or two very different aspects of risk. Hazard is the technical side of risk. Whether you're endangered, whether you're going to get hurt, whether you're going to get killed. Outrage is the non-technical side of risk. It's composed of things like voluntariness and control and dread and familiarity, a range of issues that together go to what I call outrage. And for the last 20 years, I have argued that the most interesting thing about risk is the extraordinarily low correlation between hazard and outrage. So I'm not going to go into any more detail on that, but I do want to use this distinction between hazard and outrage to locate crisis communication in the universe of risk communication. So let's graph hazard against outrage. Starting in the lower right-hand corner, you find an area where the hazard is high and the outrage is low. This is the venue of public relations. This is also the venue of health and safety education, and it's also the venue of activism. And those of you who do one of those things and don't like to think of yourselves as doing the other two, I apologize for putting them in the same yellow box. But there it is. In all three of those situations, you have the same problem. People are endangered, but they're not upset, and you're desperately trying to get their attention, trying to say, get your hepatitis B shot. or whatever the relevant issue is. In stark contrast to that, if you look at the opposite corner, the high outrage, low hazard corner, this is the venue of outrage management. Now it turns out that people are not very endangered, the hazard is very low, but people are indeed very upset. And you're trying to calm them down. And, of course, as many of you know, when you're trying to calm people down, one of the least useful things to do is to say, calm down. But what's most interesting, it seems to me, about these two is that they have almost nothing in common. That is, people who are good at public relations, who are good at alerting people to risk, may very likely be quite poor at outrage management. And I would argue, in fact, that some of the worst outrage management you ever find, you will find when a very good public relations person who isn't accustomed to coping with outrage faces outrage and doesn't notice. In the middle between these two radically different skills is a third area that I sometimes call the sweet spot. The difference is, in the sweet spot, the outrage is modest enough and the hazard is modest enough that people are interested rather than outraged on the one hand or apathetic on the other hand. What I mean to suggest by calling it the sweet spot is this is a very easy kind of risk communication. Nothing can possibly go wrong. And then finally, the fourth category, which is crisis communication, is what we're going to talk about today. High hazard, high outrage. People are upset. They are right to be upset. So if you think of this as what do you want to see happen to the outrage, in public relations, you want to see the outrage go up. You want people more upset so they'll take precautions. In outrage management, you want to see the outrage go down. You want people less upset so they won't be anxious about something that's not serious. In the sweet spot, you have no goal for the outrage. They're properly, moderately interested, and there's nothing you want to see happen. In crisis communication, I mean, if you could reduce the hazard, that would be great. Then you could reduce the outrage also. But as long as the hazard is serious, you don't want people to not take a serious hazard seriously. So in crisis communication, your goal for outrage is to help people bear it rather than to help people not feel it. And that's a difference that's going to keep coming back in the course of the presentation. Okay, so we're going to focus on crisis communication, but we're not going to focus on everything that could be said about crisis communication. We don't have the time. And let me very quickly sketch in what I consider to be the six sort of main areas of focus of crisis communication and give you a sense of which ones we're going to cover and which ones we're not. And these are not in order of importance. They're all important. They are in order from the ones that nobody ever gets wrong, nobody ever forgets to do, to the ones that are, in my judgment, neglected. The first of the six is information content. What do we know about this crisis? What do we want people to know about this crisis? And how do we say it clearly? And nobody forgets to do that. Everybody understands that it's critically important in a crisis to figure out what your information content is. And we're not going to talk about it. The second area is logistics and media. Now that we know what we want people to know, how do we reach them? Okay, what media choices do we make? And this is everything from when do you do advertising to when do you do free media to much more fundamental questions like, wouldn't it be nice if the firefighters and the cops could listen to the same radios and talk to each other? Or how much Xerox paper do you need to have ready to roll for a crisis so that you won't run out of paper? And we're not going to talk about that either. The third area is audience assessment. Who do we need to reach and what are they like? What do they already think about the issue? This is also very important. The best work done here is the mental models work done by Carnegie Mellon University, where they're really focusing a lot on understanding audience attitudes, audience opinions, audience feelings, and how those things affect how to do crisis communication. We will talk about that some. The fourth area is audience involvement. How do we make this a two-way process rather than a one-way process? How do we listen better to our publics? How do we involve them more? How do we get them into an active rather than a passive role? And we will have a fair amount to say about that. The fifth issue, and the one we're going to focus on more than any other, I call meta-messaging. It's all the content other than information content. It's should we be reassuring or should we be alarming? Should we sound confident or should we sound tentative? Should we be emotional or should we be very calm? And those kinds of questions are also questions of content, but they're not information content. They're the other content. They're not the message. They're the meta message. And I'm going to be focusing on that a lot. And finally, the sixth piece that's important is self-assessment. What is there about us that keeps us from doing it right? That is, in audience assessment, you're looking at the audience and saying, you know, what are their attitudes? What are their values? What are their biases? In self-assessment, you're looking at yourself. You're looking at the communicator, saying, what are our values? What are our prejudices? What's going to get in our way, maybe politically, maybe in some other way? And we will have some things to say about that as the seminar proceeds as well. Yes?
Do you, where do you put issue management in between crisis communications, stakeholder management? How does that fit into this program? I didn't see it listed there.
Yeah, you're right. I it's a phrase I tend not to use. I guess if I were forced to locate it somewhere, I would probably locate it more in outrage management. Because, you know, I mean, especially my corporate clients, when my corporate clients come and say they've got an issue, what they mean is people are upset or people may become upset about something that shouldn't make people upset. So that for me, that's less about a crisis than it is about outrage. Now, they may experience it as a crisis. It's a crisis for the company if people hate you, but it's not a crisis for the people who hate you unless they're in danger. So I reserve crisis communication for situations where people are actually in danger or at least have good reason to think they might be. The rest of the seminar is going to be organized into 25 numbered recommendations. Each of those recommendations is, in my judgment, at least in part, counterintuitive. That is, these are not obvious recommendations. These are recommendations to which many people's first reaction is, that can't be right. And that's why they're important. Now, I think it's useful, given that these recommendations are counterintuitive, I think it's useful to think of them as dilemmas. That is, it is possible to go too far in either direction. Most people go too far in one direction. I'm going to try to push you in the other direction. Okay. And finally, I should point out, they are policy dilemmas. This isn't just something you do after a crisis starts. This is something you think through whether you're going to do in planning your policies for the crisis. So those of you who have crisis management plans, your crisis management plan should have a crisis communication component, and that crisis communication component should deal with the kinds of meta-messaging issues that I'm going to be dealing with today. The first of the 25 recommendations is don't over-reassure. Now, the most obvious reason not to over-reassure, okay, the most obvious problem if you do over-reassure, is that you might succeed. You know, you might actually persuade people that there's nothing to worry about, and then awful things happen, and they feel blindsided, and they feel like they didn't prepare properly, and they're right, they didn't prepare properly, and they blame you. Okay. That's the most obvious problem with over-reassurance, but it's not the most common problem. The most common problem with over-reassurance is that it doesn't work, is that you try to over-reassure people, and in fact, they don't believe you. And in order to make sense out of that, I have to introduce the concept of the seesaw of risk communication. The principle of the seesaw is very straightforward but very important. Whenever people are ambivalent or confused or uncertain, and people are not always ambivalent or confused or uncertain, but whenever they are, communication happens on a seesaw. That is, if I believe X and Y simultaneously, and that's what ambivalence means, okay, then if you say X, I'm going to say Y. If you say Y, I'm going to say X. And reassurance is a spectacular example of that seesaw. Think about a crisis for a minute. I mean, probably one of the most important characteristics of a crisis, especially before it has happened, is that it's very bad and very unlikely. If it weren't very bad, it wouldn't be a crisis. And if it weren't very unlikely, we'd get used to it, and it wouldn't be a crisis. So crises are almost by definition low probability, high magnitude risks. Well, we're going to be on a seesaw almost inevitably with respect to a low probability, high magnitude risk. On the one hand, it's awful. How can you just sit there when it's so awful? On the other hand, it's really unlikely. What are you fretting about when it's really unlikely? And in that context, if as a communicator you say it's awful, people are going to respond, but it's really unlikely. If you say it's really unlikely, people are going to respond, but it's awful. And you get to decide which seat on the seesaw you want them on and which seat on the seesaw you want to take yourself. And the one you take is the one you'll preempt. The one you leave blank, the seat you leave empty on the seesaw, is the one they'll sit on. We have beautiful evidence of this from the Environmental Protection Agency's RMP program. The risk management program of EPA requires manufacturing companies in all of their facilities to calculate their worst case scenario. How could you kill the largest number of people all at once? And then they have to go tell their neighbors about it. And there have been thousands of these meetings, so we have a lot of experience with what works and what doesn't. And here's what we've learned. If you go into that kind of a meeting and you've been properly trained, and you say something like this, look, if this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens, look how many people we could kill. Okay. And you pass out plume maps, and the plume maps have LD50s on them. If you do that, it's hard to make yourself do that, isn't it? But if you do that, within a minute, somebody raises their hand and says, well, yeah, but isn't that really unlikely? Okay. And then if you've been well trained, you say, well, yeah, it is. It's really unlikely. But look how many people we could kill. Okay. And if you stay the course, if you keep insisting on how awful it is, inside of an hour, the entire room has united behind the premise that you should grow up and stop wasting our time on these exceedingly unlikely scenarios. Okay. Now you take the same audience and sit on the other side of the seesaw. If you haven't been properly trained, you go into the same room and you say, look, we're going to tell you tonight about our worst case scenario, but I have to tell you, it's not worth worrying about. You know, don't give it a second thought. We certainly don't. Okay. If you do that, you will spend the next year, maybe the next decade, arguing with your publics about how to reduce this already low probability risk down to zero probability. Okay. Well, that's the lesson of the seesaw, and that's the fundamental reason why over-reassurance backfires. Let me very quickly give you some bad examples. During the SARS outbreak of 2003, Hong Kong Health Minister E.K. Yeo said, and this is a quote, he said, and this was in fairness to Minister Yeo, this was early in the outbreak, he said, Hong Kong is absolutely safe and no different from any other big city in the world. Hong Kong does not have an outbreak, okay? And of course it wasn't okay, it was false, and he knew it was false at the time. You don't have to go to Hong Kong to see that. Tommy Thompson, talking about anthrax, prematurely and overconfidently told the American public that Robert Stevens, the first anthrax victim, probably got it from drinking from a South Carolina stream. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, talking during the 2003 blackout, said, and this is a wonderful quote, within hours of the blackout, he said, I can tell you 100% sure that there is no evidence as of this moment whatsoever of any terrorism. That's a sentence only a politician could write. What's his weasel phrase? What protects him from being found? You know, if it turns out to be terrorism, what protects him from being accused of having misled us? Anybody? Let me read it to you again. I can tell you 100% sure that there is no evidence as of this moment whatsoever of any terrorism. as of this moment, right? So if it turns out that it was terrorism, he gets to say, well, there was no evidence as of this moment, so I wasn't lying. As any of you who are familiar with the media would have predicted, CNN and the other news channels ran a caption 100% sure on the bottom of the screen, and this was widely interpreted as an assurance that that Bloomberg was confident that it was not terrorism. Now, to the best of my knowledge, he turned out right, unlike Minister Yeo and Secretary Thompson, who both turned out wrong. But the over-reassurance was there nonetheless. We could look at EPA Administrator Christy Todd Whitman talking about air quality at Ground Zero. The most famous example was probably the mad cow disease outbreak in the United Kingdom. Do you remember this one? This was a decade or so ago. And the Minister of Agriculture was a man named Gummer, who famously fed his daughter hamburger on TV. And among risk communication people, that has ever since been known as doing a Gummer. And there's a good reason why over-reassurance is so common. It's incredibly tempting. People are upset. You don't want them to be upset. It might turn out not to be serious, so your own optimism plays into it. Your desire not to damage tourism or not to damage your company plays into it. Lots of things play into it, and you're incredibly tempted to over-reassure. I will tell you as an absolute guarantee, you will over-reassure in a crisis unless you work very hard not to. Okay. Comment.
Isn't there an aspect of that where the audience wants to be reassured, and so you're just feeding into that temptation on the part of also the audience?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, doctors are very familiar with this phenomenon. If you're a clinical physician, your patient wants to be over-reassured, so you're, it's very, very tempting to make the patient happy by being over-reassuring. And exactly the same thing happens in a public health crisis. People want to be over-reassured, and it seems to me our job to resist that pressure. But you're right. The pressure comes from you. Your own psychology, it comes from your management, it comes from the industry, and it comes from the public. You got a comment?
What do you think of the terrorist color alert program? How does that fit into what you're talking about?
I wouldn't say that's an example of over-reassurance. It's kind of an example of trying hard not to be over-reassuring. I mean, it seems to me after 9/11, one of the things that the government learned, and by no means the only thing and not even the most important thing, but one of the things they learned is they are in deep, deep trouble if they seem to be confident that nothing is going to go wrong and then something goes wrong. So part of the color coding is to cover their own rear ends by warning us sufficiently that when bad things happen, we won't be able to say we weren't warned. Point two, put the reassuring information in subordinate clauses. Okay. This is not a grammar lesson. If you don't know what a subordinate clause is, don't freak out. What I'm trying to suggest is that when I tell you not to over-reassure, I don't mean to say, don't give us reassuring information. If there is reassuring information, you want to give it to us. Okay. But you want to ride that seesaw. Okay. So while you're going to give us the reassuring information, you want to give us the reassuring information in a less emphasized way than the alarming information, so that you're giving the data with which we can feel reassured, and at the same time, you're sounding alarming. Okay. And that enables us to take the more reassured position. A very good example of this, or actually a whole sequence of very good examples of this, is the CDC's head, Julie Gerberding. During the anthrax attacks, Dr. Gerberding learned, it seems to me, that this is a skill well worth using, and she has become a master of it since. And let me read you three quick quotes, all of them from Julie Gerberding, all of them on SARS, and listen for the subordination of the encouraging, reassuring information. While we have lots of reasons to think the SARS outbreaks are not due to terrorism, we're keeping an open mind and being vigilant. See? While we have reason not to worry, we're worrying. Okay? Although we haven't seen community transmission of SARS, we're not out of the woods yet. While we have reason not to worry, we're worrying. Jody has yet a more stunning example of Dr. Gerberding using this strategy. Jody?
I get to tell my favorite Dr. Gerberding story. Just in case you think that the rhetorical structure that she uses is an accident, this is my favorite story. I attended Dr. Gerberding's regular telebriefings during the SARS outbreaks. One day there was a news report about a Welsh astrobiologist who said that SARS and other viruses might come from outer space as meteor dust. Now, it had to be a very slow day on the SARS front for this story to make the newspaper, but the reporters were obligated to ask her about it. And the CNN's Miriam Falco said, very embarrassed, Dr. G, I just have to ask you about this outer space thing. What do you think? Dr. Gerberding answered with an absolutely straight face, but a wicked twinkle in her eye, and she said, although we have no evidence that SARS is from outer space, we're keeping an open mind. Peter?
Thank you. The lesson of all of these examples, but I think particularly of that one, is that you can learn these skills. These are skills that don't feel natural, but can quickly become natural and can sound natural. A format that this takes very often is, even though the news is good so far, it may get bad. One of the characteristics of crises, particularly epidemics, particularly terrorism, where it, you know, there can be a small terrorist attack, and you wonder whether, you know, there's going to be ricin all over the government next week. You worry whether this is a pilot project. So epidemics, terrorist attacks, a lot of crises start small, and the message has got to be, even though the risk right now is very low, it could get big. And you're trying to simultaneously warn us that it could get big and reassure us that it isn't big yet. Okay, number three, err on the alarming side. Well, obviously, if you could do it perfectly, you know, if you could get the size of the risk exactly right, that would be the best thing to do. But you don't know the size of the risk. You're working with a moving target. You're working with a lot of unknowns. Uncertainty is very high. So the question is, insofar as you're not sure how bad it might turn out to be, should you err on the side of reassurance or should you err on the side of alarm? And what I'm arguing is that you should err on the side of alarm. And the reason for this is very straightforward. The damage that is done if you alarm people unnecessarily is very short term. It's real. You know, it can wreak havoc with an industry for a while. But the damage that's done by over-alarming people is very short term. The damage that's done by over-reassuring people is much more serious, much more permanent, much more damaging, not just to their health, but to your reputation, to their ability to notice when the risk is over. During the Three Mile Island accident, one of the things they were very worried about is that there would be iodine-131 in local milk as a result of iodine-131, radioactive iodine, escaping from the Three Mile Island plant during the accident. So the Commissioner of Health, almost immediately after the accident, issued a news release in which he said, we're anticipating that they may very well be iodine-131 in local milk. Don't drink local milk. Then he did some first round of tests, found no iodine-131 in the milk, and issued a second news release in which he said, we did some tests, we didn't find any iodine-131 in the milk. We figured, you know, it hasn't made it through the cow's digestive system yet. Don't drink local milk. 2 days later, still no iodine-131 in the milk. Third news release, we haven't found any iodine-131 in the milk yet. We still expect to find it. It's taking longer getting, you know, maybe it's still, you know, in the grass. Maybe it's still in the digestive system. It's taking longer than we thought. Don't drink local milk. Fourth release, now we're 7 days or so into the accident. Still haven't found any iodine-131 in the milk. We're beginning to think there isn't any, but we're not sure yet. We want to do some more careful testing. We want to do some more sensitive testing. Don't drink local milk. 2 days after that, fifth news release, this is now about 11 days into the accident, we are now convinced that there isn't any iodine-131 in the milk. We apologize for having over-alarmed people and for having warned people against milk, which turns out to be safe. Go ahead and drink local milk. Sales of local milk rebounded 100 percent. Okay? I mean, he cost them 10 days of sales. Had the health department begun by saying, there is no evidence that local milk is dangerous, go ahead and drink it, they still wouldn't be drinking it in central Pennsylvania. And to give you a good example from SARS, some of the best handling of SARS came from Singapore. I don't know exactly why. I do not understand why. But the Prime Minister of Singapore was superb on many aspects of SARS. And one of them was this business of that I'm recommending of erring on the alarming side. The same day that the World Health Organization lifted Canada's travel warning, and you may remember that Canada was extremely whiny about that travel warning. You know, how dare you tell people not to come to Toronto? At the same time as the WHO lifted Canada's travel warning, it also said that the worst of Singapore's SARS outbreak seemed to be over. Okay, so it basically said Singapore is over the worst. At that moment, Singapore's health ministry spokeswoman, Eunice Teo, responded, I think, masterfully. She, in terms of the seesaw, she moved to the fulcrum of the seesaw, and here's what she said. The WHO said the peak is over in Singapore, but our minister has said it is too early to tell. Isn't that spectacular? Here's the World Health Organization saying Singapore's safe, and here's the Singapore Department of Health saying, we're not so sure, give it another week. Okay, number four, acknowledge uncertainty. And once again, the seesaw is our guide. The question before us is, do our leaders, our government leaders, our industry leaders, do our technical leaders, do our leaders know what they're talking about? Okay. Do they really understand this situation cold? And that's a seesaw. Some are going to take the position, there's always more to be learned, but they seem to have a handle on it. And some is going to take the position, they really don't seem to know what's going on. And that's a seesaw. And you want to be on the side of the seesaw that you don't want the public on. So if you're focusing on how uncertain this situation is, on how bewildered you are, on how many unanswered questions there are, paradoxically, people feel you got a pretty good understanding of the problem. Okay. If you try to sound like you have a really good understanding of the problem and we smell out the uncertainties and we smell out your unwillingness to let us know about those uncertainties, then our confidence is damaged. Now, that's not obvious to anybody. It is the most natural mistake in the world if you want people to trust you to sound more confident than you actually are. Much as over-reassurance is inevitable unless you plan and work hard to prevent it, sounding overconfident is also extremely unlikely unless you work hard to prevent it. The comment that was made earlier that the public seduces us into this is again relevant. People want you to sound overconfident. If you sound tentative, they'll be critical of you, for sounding tentative. If you sound confident, they'll be critical of you for sounding confident. They're either going to accuse you of arrogance or they're going to accuse you of timidity. And you get to choose which accusation you'd like. And essentially what I am arguing is the accusation of timidity does you much less harm. It's possible to go too far. It's possible to come across as bumbling and insecure and out of your element and incapable of handling the situation. I want to assure you that's not going to be your problem. Okay? It's a very, very rare leader that goes too far in the direction of acknowledging tentativeness. What we all tend to do is go not far enough. The biggest reason, of course, to avoid sounding too certain and in fact to insist on your uncertainty is what happens if you sound certain and you end up wrong. Not necessarily even completely wrong, just a little bit wrong, not completely right. If you're lucky, we'll think you made serious mistakes. If you're not so lucky, we'll think you misled us on purpose. Vicky Frymuth, who used to be CDC communications director and was their communications director during the anthrax attacks, one of the lessons learned that she has written about is that people, particularly the press, tend to treat evolving knowledge as mistakes. Okay. So you are uncertain, you don't know things, and as things go on, you learn more. And the press are very likely to see that very natural process that's inevitable in any crisis. You learn more as the crisis goes on. They're very likely to see that as having made mistakes that you later discovered and corrected. Okay. Well, there's a lesson to be learned there. Part of the lesson, and in some ways the most important part of the lesson, is to acknowledge the uncertainty early on so that it won't look like a mistake when you have to correct it later. There's a scale here. Overconfidence is the worst level, stating or implying that you're certain when you're not. Avoiding overconfidence gets you half credit. For full credit, you need to assert explicitly that you're not confident. And for extra credit, you go beyond asserting that you're not confident, and you predict that much of what you now think is true will turn out wrong. Okay. And this also is learnable. You can learn. If you agree with me that one of the characteristics of a crisis is you learn things. One of the characteristics of a crisis is you think things in day one of the crisis, day three of the crisis, day five of the crisis, that by day 20 of the crisis, you know are false. If that's true, and it's been true in every crisis I've ever worked on or looked at, if you know that's going to be true, then on day one, you certainly want to sound uncertain because you know you're going to come crawling back saying we were wrong. Okay? But you can do better than sound uncertain. You can say some of the things we now think are true, we will learn over the next 2 weeks, are not true. You can say that in so many words. Okay. You can even say, and people will be tempted to think we got it wrong, and in some sense we did get it wrong, but we know we're going to get some things wrong. That's how crises are. Jeff Copeland, who was CDC director during anthrax, Copeland did this, I think, very well during the anthrax attacks, and I want to read you, a very good Copeland quote on this subject. He said, "I think people are somewhat surprised that we're learning things on a day-by-day basis, but that's really no different from any other investigation that we've done this year, 5 years, over the last 50 years. The way the natural history of these investigations are, you always wish you knew on day one what you know on day 20, and it's probably not going to be different here. We learn new things almost daily in this, and we try to anticipate, of course, what's coming up the next day or the next week." Some of the very specific advice for sounding tentative, for acknowledging uncertainty. One, abandon the word confident. Just get rid of it altogether. Or use it only when saying alarming things. Whenever you're saying anything reassuring, replace confident with hopeful. Julie Gerberding, again, does this very nicely. The only time she uses the word confident these days is to say things like, "I'm confident more states will have widespread flu outbreaks before this is over." You know, she often expressed confidence that bad things will happen. She never anymore expresses confidence that good things will happen. She waits until they happen. A second piece of explicit advice, make your content more tentative than your tone. The worst of all possible ways of handling this is to have confident content in a tentative tone. You know, to have a tone that suggests you don't know what you're doing and content that says everything's under control. That terrifies people. The opposite combination is the best. Okay, to have a tone that's confident, that's calm, that's self-aware, and a content that says, we're going to be learning things in the next 2 weeks that we will wish and you will wish we'd known when we started. I should mention quickly that warnings can be overconfident, too. I've been talking about overconfident reassurance because that's the worst problem. That's sort of the double-barreled mistake, to be overconfident and over-reassuring at the same time. But overconfident warnings are also common. The next one is Jody's.
Next recommendation is to share dilemmas. Dilemma sharing is actually a lot like acknowledging uncertainty, but now we're not talking about what happened or what's going to happen. We're talking about what you should do about it. "I don't know" is hard enough to say. "I'm not sure what to do" is even harder. If you haven't made a decision yet, say so. Outline the options and the pros and cons of each and ask for help. This has many advantages, one of which is that you may actually get some help. You will also get your publics to understand that the decision isn't easy. Once you make it, you'll get more buy-in from the people you consulted than from the people who were left in the dark. and those who preferred a different option are likely to be less critical. Here's a good example. Again, it's from Singapore during SARS. Singapore, which is a country we usually think of as pretty authoritarian, that's the stereotype of Singapore, and from what I know, it's pretty true, they did extraordinary dilemma sharing with their public. Senior public officials talked openly about their debates on whether to overreact or whether to underreact. They requested citizen input at public meetings on all sorts of open questions that they hadn't decided yet. Most interestingly, they asked the public, should we list the names of the people that are on home quarantine? Because there was a lot of worry about people evading home quarantine and spreading the disease. So should we list their names? Should we use volunteers, or should we use private security services, or should we use public servants to help tend to the people under home quarantine and incidentally monitor them? 10 months later, this month, a research article published in the US CDC's Emerging Infectious Disease Journal showed that the factor in Singapore most highly correlated with people taking the recommended SARS precautions was the citizens' belief that they could communicate with their government. You can also do dilemma sharing on a decision that you've already made. If you've already decided, but the decision was a close call and could still turn out wrong, and especially if the decision has unavoidable downsides that make it less than optimal, say so. You can outline the options that you considered and the pros and cons of each, making it clear why you decided as you did, but also making it clear that there were some good arguments for another choice. When all the options have serious costs, calmly but humanly share your anguish about this. Above all, we recommend using dilemma sharing when you have made some preliminary decisions, but the issue is far from closed, when you're still open to influence. This makes it ideal for a crisis that hasn't arrived yet, or that might have arrived, but you're not sure. Shortly after the anthrax attacks, people were worried, what happens if a smallpox attack happens? How will we know? How will we know early on? So the doctors worried about those idiopathic, unusual cases of chickenpox that might actually be smallpox, but nobody would know right away. We recommended that people share this dilemma. What should we do if there's an unusual case of chickenpox? Should we quarantine everybody until we're sure? Even worse, what should we do the third time we have an idiopathic case of chickenpox and everyone is fed up from the previous quarantines? Sharing dilemmas is especially useful in controversial, costly, and painful recommendations. Officials who make difficult, debatable decisions look easy and obvious are colluding with one of the public's less mature traits, its somewhat passive desire to be taken care of by an all-knowing government. The public will try to seduce you into doing this, and it's your job to resist it. There's a very good example of extremely painful dilemma sharing going on right now in February 2004. And this is in regard to avian flu. The World Health Organization explained to the world that the best way to slow or stop the avian flu epidemic is by the widespread killing of millions of chickens, even ones that are not obviously sick. They announced this decision. Then they shared the agonizing dilemmas this raises for the millions of poor backyard farmers in Asia and for the health of the world. One dilemma: the speed necessary to kill the chickens puts the workers at risk because there isn't time to train the workers well enough, and there isn't time to get all the workers protective clothing. So the workers are more at risk of catching bird flu, even though it's better for the world if the chickens are killed fast. The short-term economic disaster of killing off all those chickens, especially the healthy ones, for these poor farmers is a disastrous cost to them, but it's in their longer-term interest because the sooner the epidemic gets wiped out, the sooner everybody can start getting their economic growth underway again. The need to slaughter one of the food sources of these poor people is a devastating dilemma, and it's necessary, again, for the longer-range good. And I'll give you one example of the dilemmas they shared that kind of has a public relations implication, although that's not the reason that they're doing it. They've been very open about the fact that the need for speed in killing all these chickens means that the chickens are being killed in much less humane ways than we would like to kill animals in the world where we take animal well-being seriously. I believe as a result of sharing this dilemma, even though the animal rights groups around the world have made some noise about the inhumane killing of the chickens, the criticism is much more muted than it would be if WHO hadn't been upfront about acknowledging this painful dilemma. Expect the public to resent your indecisiveness. You can't get out of this part of it. This is a seesaw of its own. When the authorities exercise their power, the public demands a voice. When the authorities consult openly and express uncertainty, the public asks, whatever happened to leadership? Choose the latter problem over the former. Resist the temptation to decide unilaterally, to sound confident, to pretend there is no dilemma. Most of all, tell people that you know how miserable this uncertainty makes them and that it makes you miserable too. Tell them that you will resist the temptation to sound confident when you are not, and you hope they will resist the temptation to blame you for not being sure. Peter?
I think it's probably clear that there's a sequence here. I mean, acknowledging uncertainty has to do with the seesaw about what happened. And the seesaw, do you know what happened? Do you know what's going to happen? What Jody had to say about dilemmas is, do you know what to do about it? And that leads directly to the next point, to acknowledge opinion diversity. To me, what's absolutely shocking on this issue as I work on it with client after client after client is I work endlessly with organizations that rightly encourage robust debate and somehow imagine it's important to pretend that they don't. To pretend that everybody is required to follow the party line. And you understand what they're worried about. They're worried about undermining the policy. And of course, it is important not to undermine the policy. What undermines the policy? It undermines the policy if you say the organization just decided X and that's a really stupid decision. Can't imagine why they made it. That undermines the policy. Undermines the policy if you have no idea what the organization decided. If one employee is out there saying, X is our policy, and another employee is out there saying Y is our policy, then it's perfectly clear you don't know what you're doing, and the organization is not properly under control. What doesn't undermine policy is to say, this was a difficult decision. We had people in our organization who wanted to do it this way. We had people in our organization who wanted to do it this way. We had a lot of debate, and finally it went all the way to the commissioner. It went all the way to the vice president, whatever the situation is. And she made the decision, and we're going to do it this way. And that's not a stupid decision. She decided that was the right way to go for this reason and this reason and this reason and this reason. Some of us would have rather gone the other way. But it was a tough call, and she made it, and that's now the policy. And I would argue, with, I think, considerable data, that when you do that, you do not undermine the policy. You demonstrate that policies are made by organizations, when they're good organizations, that consider all the alternatives, that are staffed by human beings who often, thank God, disagree. On smallpox vaccination, for example, obviously an important question of terrorism protection. There was a lot of debate over how many Americans to vaccinate against smallpox. And as some of you know, one side, represented by most of the public health establishment, wanted to vaccinate almost nobody. The American Committee on Immunization Practices, the ACIP, recommended vaccinating a handful of people. On the other side, represented mostly by the intelligence establishment, they wanted to vaccinate just about everybody. So you had intelligence people for whom the possibility of a smallpox attack was very vivid in their minds, who wanted nearly universal vaccination. You had public health people who couldn't imagine a smallpox attack, but really could imagine the side effects of the smallpox vaccination program, who wanted to vaccinate very few. That was a public debate. It went on in op-ed articles, it went on before Congress, and it went all the way to the president who reached a compromise, who decided to vaccinate a whole lot more people than the CIA wanted to, a whole lot fewer people than the CIA wanted to, and a whole lot more people than the ACIP wanted to. Both sides lost. And it was terrific. It was exactly the right thing to do, and thereafter, they screwed it up. Thereafter, it went underground, and all the people in the public health establishment who were supposed to carry out this program were under, or imagined themselves to be under, instructions to pretend that they had supported it. So they did what you do when you're being asked to pretend you supported something you didn't support. They got passive-aggressive. They got hostile. They did a whole bunch of things that, at least unconsciously and maybe consciously, were inevitably going to undermine the program. It would have been far better for the program if they had continued the robust debate after the decision. There's another smallpox example that I'll tell you more briefly, and that had to do with the likelihood of side effects from the smallpox vaccine. There are a handful of experts in the United States prior to the vaccination program who had opinions on what percentage of people who got vaccinated would have serious side effects. The term of art is adverse event. I tried to get them to say horrific side effect instead, and I wasn't always successful. So there was a debate. And the CDC, in what I thought was a mistake, decided that it was important not to let that debate show. So they tried to get all the experts on the probability of smallpox vaccine side effects and involve them in a process of coming up with one number to represent the real probability. All right, what's the downside of that? What happens if you get all the experts to agree on one number? What goes wrong? Well, first of all, let me ask you this. When the final number is reached, when they've actually vaccinated a bunch of people and they know how many people had side effects, what are we going to conclude about the consensus estimate? It was wrong. It's, you know, as soon as you come up with a consensus estimate of something which started out with a pretty wide range of estimates, you're almost certain your consensus estimate is going to be wrong. Okay? So they would have been setting themselves up to be wrong. The other awful thing that happens is reporters smell a rat. So even before you turn out wrong, reporters are interviewing experts saying, I notice you've signed on to the consensus estimate, but 2 years ago you wrote an article in a journal in which you had quite a different estimate. Were you under pressure to change your mind? The CDC did back off of that and allowed alternative expert estimates to exist. And the CDC basically wound up saying, look, you know, the range is somewhere between this number and this number. So it seems to me there are many, many advantages to letting expert disagreement show, to letting opinion diversity in your organization show.